Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge, and I'm very glad to have you listening this morning. I wonder, have you ever had this fantasy that maybe you would like to walk away from your present life, abandon it completely, wipe the slate clean, and start again? I think it's likely probably a fair number of people have had that fantasy. It seems that as human beings, we spend a lot of energy trying to outrun the past, and it seems that almost always the past manages to catch up. This morning, in the first part of the show, we'll be talking with a novelist who explores some of these themes, ideas of forgetting and remembering, in a novel. It's titled The Missing World. It is her third. It's now available in paperback editions published by Penguin. It just came out this spring. She's visiting here in Champaign-Urbana. In fact, she'll be giving a reading from The Missing World at the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4 o'clock. So anyone who is in the area here is welcome to attend, to hear her, and to meet her. Her visit here is sponsored by the Creative Writing Program in the Department of English, and we're pleased that our friend Philip Graham has made it possible for us to talk with her. She's the author of four books, a story collection, Learning by Heart, and the novels Homework, Criminals, and The Missing World. She also has completed a fourth that's titled Eva Moves the Furniture and will be published this fall. She's a recipient of a fellowship from the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. She grew up in Scotland and now divides her time between London and Massachusetts, where she's writer in residence at Emerson College. As we talk with Margot Livesey, you're certainly welcome to call in. Maybe you have a question, comment somewhere along the line you'd like to join the conversation, and you would be welcome to do that here in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, 800-222-9455 is the number. And again, any point here, anyone is welcome to join the conversation. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. I'm delighted to be here. My first visit to Champaign.
Not such a bad place. A little on the flat side. No ocean, but there's got to be some redeeming features. Well, we can talk about them later, I guess. I'd like to perhaps begin by sketching out a little bit of the story of The Missing World, and I promise we won't give too much away, because I would encourage people to read it. I think it's a good read. But the central piece of this story does involve a woman who is involved in an accident, and as a result, she loses her memory. Not her entire memory, but her memory for the couple of years right before the accident occurs.
Yes, and that was actually one of the things that propelled me to write the book, was reading a story in People magazine. I think I must have been in my dentist's waiting room. And it was about a couple who were getting married after their second engagement. And the first engagement had been broken off when the woman was in an accident and lost all memory of her fiancé. And he was quoted in the interview as saying that he soon realized it wasn't enough to come in and say, "Hey, honey, I'm the guy you're going to marry," that he sort of had to start over again and court her for a second time and see if she might fall in love with him again. And indeed, in that story, she did. But I was very struck by that and by all the issues and questions it raised about memory and the self and things that I think are pressing for many of us at this time, was people with our perhaps elderly parents worrying about losing their memory, and cases about repressed memory syndrome and questions of cultural memory. It seems like as a culture we've become very preoccupied with memory.
Well, I was interested to hear that story or read that story about being inspired by the story in People, because in another interview I read a quote that you said, one of the ways I start writing is by looking at newspapers and listening to people and looking for something to capture my interest. You'll probably catch me in the drugstore reading the National Enquirer and call it research. So it was pretty close.
Yes.
It was pretty close. And I guess that also that this was in part inspired by some experiences that you had with, what was it, a relative or a family friend?
I think there were really two other aspects to the story. One was that some acquaintances of mine, something similar happened to them. Again, the woman lost a discrete part of her memory, in that case, 3 or 4 years. And again, the man was in the position of sort of having the slate wiped clean, and a long history of arguments and difficulties suddenly disappeared. And they were back in the kind of romantic first phase of their relationship. And I found that so interesting to observe long distance. And there was something I thought rather spooky about the fact that he knew so much about their relationship and she knew so little. And I think the other part, the more personal part, is that I lost my mother when I was very young. I was 2.5 when she died, and I have no memory of her. And so, you know, in a way, the most important person in my life is someone I can't remember. So I think that was also part of what propelled me towards writing this novel. I mean, how important is it for us to remember things? What happens if we do forget things? Do we have some other kind of memory other than the kind we can give voice to?
Well, we just mentioned just the tiniest bit about this book, the fact that, yes, it starts out because we have a woman who loses this part of her memory. But then what we learn is that shortly some period before this happens, she has had a falling out with the man that she was living with. They were living together. They broke up. She moves out. Then she has the accident. She loses the memory for this couple of year period before the accident. And he decides to take her in, thinking that maybe what they can do with their relationship is indeed start from the beginning. Because, of course, whatever it was that happened, she doesn't remember. He does, and other people do, but she doesn't.
Yeah, no, when I thought more about this subject, I thought, well, it's great. You have a chance to have your life over again. You get the good parts and you can forget the mistakes or ignore the mistakes or hopefully learn from the mistakes, but without having to revisit them. So it seemed like a potentially idyllic situation. One I have to confess that I'd often fantasized having in my own life.
Mm-hmm. I did. There's another wonderful quote that I came across in something here. I think maybe it was in the New York Times, where you said something to the effect of, unlike Edith Piaf, I regret everything.
Really
true.
Maybe that was an especially grim day. I mean, it's not always everything, but I certainly have major regrets or things I would like to do over again with hindsight and knowledge and more tact and compassion.
Well, I think that really is one of the major ideas in the book, that everyone does, and that we do try pretty hard with certain things in our past to pretend that those things didn't happen. And so much of the time, that just proves impossible. Sure, we can pretend that those things didn't happen, and yet they are part of us, and they shape the way that we, you know, deal with other people and the way we deal with situations. And so the past, really, you really can't do that as much as you might like to.
But it's interesting that you say that, David, as an American, because I think these are peculiarly American questions. Americans have a long tradition of moving on, of leaving their past behind, of reinventing themselves, you know, first by coming from Europe or Africa or wherever, and then by moving across the country and finally sort of stopping at California. And I think that, you know, many people here do live a long way from the place they grew up. I mean, there are many Americans who sort of live as expatriates within America, reinventing themselves. There's no one to say, don't you remember in fifth grade when you did such and such, and point the finger at you.
And this maybe we should mention that the book, The Missing World, is set in London, and a society that is a little bit different for many reasons, I expect. But one is that people are closer together. People don't go as far from home. And maybe in that respect, it's a little bit more difficult to get away from your past.
Yes. I mean, I think one of the challenges of the novel was setting it in London, because I think it is harder to reinvent yourself in Britain. Most people, statistically speaking, in Britain still live within something like 20 miles of where they grew up. So it's hard to pretend that what happened at school or as a child or as a young person didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. There is, in fact, a character in the book who is American, the one of the major characters. And I'm interested in how it is that you chose to, in this group of British people, put an American.
Well, I think in my last novel, Criminals, the one I wrote before The Missing World, I was conscious that I was pointing the finger at everyone except myself. And so in that novel, I included a writer so that I could talk about my besetting sin, which is writing about people I know. And in this novel, I had the same feeling of wanting to somehow include myself. And the way to do that seemed to be to include an expatriate, someone who's trying to reinvent themselves by moving to another country.
Mm-hmm. And like a lot of other people in the book, there is something in his past that he is trying to get away from.
Yes, and I think that's another aspect of the book that maybe it's hard to summarize, but the central couple, Jonathan and Hazel, are surrounded by these other characters who each have their own issues with memory and in many cases are practicing a kind of willed amnesia, where Hazel wants to remember, the other characters mostly want to forget.
Mm-hmm. And are not terribly successful at it, obviously, because the things that they're trying to forget continue to haunt them.
Yes.
Yeah. As you've said here, at the center of the story are Hazel and Jonathan, the woman who loses her memory and the former boyfriend who takes her in, thinking that somehow he can engineer their reunion because now he has, in a sense, has control of the past. She doesn't know what happens, although gradually she starts to sort of figure out that things aren't the way that he says that they are. And then there is another group of people that are drawn into the situation a bit by accident, in a way, and come to know each other by accident and are really drawn to the situation because they're concerned about Hazel and whether or not, you know, how Jonathan is treating her and what exactly his motives are.
Yeah, well, again, you summarize my novel so accurately. One of my concerns was that I didn't want to write a hospital or a medical novel, partly because I simply didn't know enough to do that successfully, even though I interviewed quite a number of people who had found themselves in Hazel's situation. And so when I thought about the novel, I thought I really wanted to write something which had, in some ways, the plot almost of a thriller. You know, there's an emergency, there's a crisis, and all these people converge on the situation and sort of struggle over Hazel. Who will rescue her? Will she be rescued? Will she rescue herself?
In another of the things that I read about you, there was you said something to the effect of you like there to be a mystery in the book, and perhaps at some point in which the reader is going to continue to turn the pages because he or she is going to want to find out what happens. And also, I have seen some references to your writing as suspense novels or thrillers or something like that. And I wonder, do you in fact think that that's an accurate word to choose to describe the books that you've written?
I feel uneasy about the word thriller when it's juxtaposed with my work, but I've come to understand that it's a euphemism at this point for a readable novel, for a novel that that we want to read. And when I'm writing, I very much have my sisters in Scotland in mind, both of whom are ardent readers and both of whom have very demanding jobs. And they read mostly in bed before they go to sleep at night. So I'm always thinking that I'll try to keep them awake for 5 minutes more.
Mm-hmm. Our guest this morning in this first part of Focus 580, novelist Margot Livesey. And we're talking about her novel, The Missing World, her third. It is now out in paper, just come out recently from Penguin. So if you're interested in reading it, you can find it. She also has written two others entitled Homework and Criminals, and there's one that will be coming probably in the fall. She's here visiting the campus and will be giving a reading at the Alina Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4. So if you'd like to hear more from her, maybe have an autographed copy of the book. I think that could be arranged. And questions, of course, are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. The character of the boyfriend, Jonathan, is, as I think as one learns more about him, one likes him less and less. At least that was my reaction. And I think I also read something to the effect that you at least wanted people to be, if not sympathetic, at least to feel that you understood the character and what his motivation was. And I'm interested in your feeling about that character?
Jonathan was quite challenging for me to write. I mean, I had the idea for the novel and a kind of space in which I knew Jonathan had to exist before I exactly had the character. I think I'm really interested in what sort of ordinary people will do given rather extraordinary circumstances. You know, what would you do if you found a baby in a bus station, which is what happened in my novel Criminals, or what would you do if you found $1 million, or what would you do if, you know. And the case of Jonathan, I mean, he gets this extraordinary situation. He gets something he devoutly wanted, a second chance with Hazel. He gets that in an extraordinary form, not by her consciously forgiving him, but by her forgetting all the things he's done that have driven her out of the relationship. So I wanted you to understand the extremity that drives him, and to think with some tiny part of your brain, oh, well, maybe I could go some part of that distance. I hope that most of my readers would not go as far as Jonathan, but I hope that they could at least fantasize acting in an unusual way, given an unusual set of events.
He's a very controlling person, to say the very least.
Yeah. Well, I have a decrepit house in London, and over the years I've met Jonathan's profession is he's a claims adjuster for an insurance company, and claims adjusters are a peculiar breed. They're both sort of hyper accurate, and they believe that everyone is a liar. I mean, that's the place from which they're operating. So it breeds a certain cynicism and skepticism.
Yeah. And it's sort of ironic that he's the insurance claims adjuster, as is the place that he lives is. It's not in tip-top condition.
Right, yes. He doesn't manage quite to file his own claims. But again, it has to do with an idea. Insurance claims adjusters are basically evaluating the past. You tell them a story about the hole in your roof, and they decide if that's the true story, the true history.
Mm. And the character that we mentioned, the American character, who is in fact an African-American, and finds and is trying to escape his past and finds himself in London, is working as a roofer, and he comes to repair the roof at the place where Jonathan and Hazel are living, and that's the way he gets pulled into this story. What interests me is that he becomes very concerned about Hazel, and I wonder what, as you think about the character of Hazel, here we have two men who seem to become obsessed with her. The one who just can't let her go, can't say, no, this is not over. We're going to do this again. And the one who decides that she needs to be rescued. What is it about Hazel you think that grabs these two men the way that she does?
Well, I think rather different things. I think in Jonathan's case, you know, he led this rather straitjacketed life, and she represented a kind of freedom and curiosity and spirit that some part of him yearned for, and that perhaps was expressed in his hobby of beekeeping, but not in any other way in his life. And in Freddie, the roofer's case, I think he has what I call in my novel a Lourdes complex. He used to work as a stretcher bearer at the Catholic shrine of Lourdes in France, and He thinks that he can find himself, that he can redeem his life by helping people. And Hazel seems an excellent case for that.
Mm-hmm. We're approaching the midpoint of the program. Let me again just mention we're talking with novelist Margot Livesey. She will be giving a reading from this book we're talking about, The Missing World, this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Illini Union Bookstore on the U of I campus. And I was hoping that perhaps you might read a little bit for us here this morning.
That would be a pleasure. Did you have a particular passage in mind?
Well, not necessarily. I expect that you have prepared something, and I would just leave it to you to choose.
Well, then in that case, maybe I'll read the opening.
Very good.
As David already explained, this is set in contemporary London, but just before the period when everyone had a mobile phone. They were quarrelling on the phone when it happened, although anyone overhearing them might easily have failed to detect the fury that lay behind their pragmatic sentences. "I don't see why you need to bother Mrs. Craig," Hazel said, "about a leak in your study." "But my hunch," said Jonathan, is that the water's getting in through her roof as well as ours. No use fixing one without the other. He was standing beside the window, tugging at the dusty leaves of the indomitable cheese plant. Since Hazel's flight, the other plants had one by one succumbed to his lack of care, and now sat, brown and desiccated, on windowsills and tables. This monster, however, almost as tall as he was, with its perforated leaves and hairy roots groping from the lower stems, had not merely survived his abuse, but positively thrived. In the midst of his struggle with Hazel, he found time to apostrophize his old enemy. "Die, you bugger," he thought, and shredded a leaf. The brittle green flakes were still falling when Hazel's steady speech swerved, slewed across several lanes, hesitated at the guardrail, and plunged off into a dark field. "Elephants," she whispered. "Caracals." "Hazel, is something wrong? Hazel?"
And then what we go on to learn, of course, is that so he's at his place and she's at hers, and she has just immediately had this experience. She gets hit by a car, and she, you know, the person stops and says, "Are you all right?" And she says, "I think I'm okay, but, you know," she goes home. And so they're having this conversation on the telephone, and Jonathan, obviously something's wrong. And so then he leaps in the car and drives over there and finds that she's not well, and she ends up going to hospital, and then the story goes on from there.
No, one of the pleasures of the novel was researching, this sounds awful actually as I'm saying it, was researching head injuries and memory. Both turn out to be, in spite of all the progress in modern medicine, both turn out to be still quite mysterious. Most of the doctors I talked to found it very hard to analyze how head injuries worked and the whole range of different effects that could result from similar injuries. And comparably, even experts on memory could not really tell me how the memory worked and the different ways in which memory functions in the brain and how, for instance, maybe you can remember how to ride a bicycle, but you can't remember your dog's name. And so it was interesting to reach a kind of frontier in modern medicine where many people are working very ardently, but looking into a rather mysterious future at this point.
Well, I think, though, to me what's interesting is that, again, it makes the point that people who write fiction do a lot of research to learn about the things that they're writing about, that they may begin with an idea about a particular kind of story that they'd like to tell, and then they feel, well, I need to know some more about these things before I can actually go out and do them.
I mean, I think that, for me at least, research is a great springboard for the imagination. And similarly with Freddie the roofer, I spent a lot of time talking to roofers in London, and it turns out to be a disturbingly maverick profession. You know, practically anyone who has a ladder and a hammer can claim to be a roofer. So you get a whole level of expertise in this job.
That just I think about not very long ago, I talked with a novelist who lives in Texas and who wrote this novel that is set around the Johnstown flood.
Oh, what a great subject.
And she talks about the fact that what happens in this novel is that there is an artificial earthen dam is created and builds up this reservoir behind it. And over a period of years, the dam is not properly maintained. And eventually the dam breaks. Great metaphor. And it caused a great deal of damage in this town in Pennsylvania. It was a real thing. And one of the things that she said in the interview was, "Now, if anybody asks me how to build an earthen dam, I can tell them." Because she actually went out and had to learn about, okay, how was such a thing constructed and how do you do it properly and what are some of the things that would go wrong with it. And more and more, as I talk to people who write fiction, I guess I'm coming to realize and appreciate the fact that it is made up, but it's not completely made up. And there are certain things you feel, well, I need to know about this so that then when you write about that in the book, you know that you've got it right.
Because fiction is my main reading and the main way I learn about the world, I feel really concerned to make my novels as accurate as possible insofar as they map onto the real world. And I think most readers can tell when I'm sort of imagining and when I'm trying to be accurate.
Mm-hmm. Well, Hazel, the character who loses her memory, is a journalist. Have you ever been inclined to do more nonfiction writing, or was there ever some point? I wonder if for a lot of novelists, whether they at some point think, well, maybe I would have been a journalist, or I'd like to be a journalist, or, you know, you always hear the joke about the journalist who has the Great American Novel in their desk drawer.
Right. So in fact, does almost every taxi driver I meet these days. I've never been tempted by journalism, although I have a number of friends who are wonderful journalists, and I admire their drive to write about the world as it is, the world around them, and the way they can do this often under very harassing circumstances. I'm afraid I need more time to get things on the page. You know, if I had a deadline of next Tuesday, it would completely panic me. Mm. I would need the deadline to be a year on Tuesday to get my articles sorted out. Mm-hmm. But I do like writing nonfiction. I do write essays and book reviews.
Yeah. How long did it take to write The Missing World?
It took about maybe 2 years to write something like a draft of the novel, and then maybe I spent another year and a half revising it. Hmm. At first, I wrote it really from Jonathan's point of view, and then I felt that was too claustrophobic. And so I went back and started bringing in more and more characters. I wanted more space in the novel, and I wanted to be able to say more complicated things about memory than I could say just from his point of view. And I didn't want to spend that much time with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does. It deals with a lot of fascinating and I think very basic ideas, as we've talked about this idea that one might like this idea, the idea of wiping the slate clean would be attractive. I think if you thought about it for about 2 minutes, you'd realize, no, maybe that wouldn't be such a good thing. But of course, for Hazel, it's a terrible thing. And so it does invite you to think about what it would be like truly to lose one's memory.
Well, Hazel gradually shifts her position on memory. She, as the novel progresses, she begins to realize that she isn't going to recover those missing years. They're not going to come back to her in the way she hopes when she first comes out of hospital. But what she does become more confident about is trusting her own feelings and intuitions and her sense of self, a sense of self that doesn't depend entirely on articulate memory. And so when her dislike of Jonathan and her distrust of him begins to surface, she increasingly trusts that feeling, even though she has nothing to back it up, because on the surface he's just being incredibly kind and helpful.
Mm-hmm. And that also, I guess, suggests that there is more than one kind of memory, that in her case, that while she didn't remember what had happened in the weeks and the months before this accident, and while Jonathan continued to tell her, I love you, I care about you, I'm here to take care of you, everything's going to be great, just like it was, she hears that, and yet, obviously, there's some other kind of deeper memory that inside her is saying, something here isn't right. There's a feeling that she has that things aren't quite right, even though she can't put words to that, it can definitely say why it is that way. But that leads one to think about there's memory and then there's memory.
Yes, and I think the novel finally makes an argument for us ideally needing both kinds of memory, both the kind that we can give voice to in sentences beginning, I remember this and I remember that, and the kind that resides at a different, less articulate level, where we may not be able to give reasons or conjure up precise scenes, but where we have feelings and intuitions and instincts.
Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit about the fact that people, they act like they could wipe the slate clean and sometimes might want to pretend there, perhaps for everyone or almost everyone, there will be things in the past that you would prefer to believe that they just didn't happen, that you could, you know, that you could do that. And given everything that happens, the course the story takes, at the end, he seems steadfastly unwilling to let go of the idea that the slate can be wiped clean, because it seems as if he is so self-deluded that at the end he's telling himself, no, see, of course, that time I didn't do it right, but I can go back at the beginning and start again, and this time do it right. He just doesn't want to believe that what he's trying to do is just not possible.
Yes, I struggled with the ending. I mean, as a reader, I think part of me is always, and as a writer, part of me is always yearning for a happy ending. And as a reader and as a writer, part of me is always skeptical about a happy ending. I mean, I wish we had more novels that ended like the great 19th century novels. You know, reader, I married him, as if that were the end of the story. So, and I think you can see both impulses playing out in the way I cast the ending of The Missing World. I believe that in real life people do change, but I think I don't believe that they change according to a timetable. Mm-hmm. And so I think 10 years from now, Jonathan may be a much improved person, but by the end of my novel, he's not a much improved person, sad to say.
Well, that's interesting, because it seems that while the characters might have gained some small insight through the course of the story, they do seem to be mostly in the place where they started. At the end, they seem mostly in the place where they started. And so it's not necessarily, I suppose, if one wanted to hang on to some shred of optimism, you could find it. Or if you wanted to say, well, how like life, there are no happy endings, you could have that one. Maybe you could pick the one that you like.
Well, I actually see the end of the novel as a little more positive, perhaps, than we're sounding at this moment, because I do see a sort of reversal occurring, that Hazel, who begins as helpless, rises up to begin to take back control of her own life. She stops being a patient and becomes an active participant in her own life. And so she is going forward, and in her wake, she is carrying other people to new places, although they may not get there as quickly as she does. Mm-hmm. So I don't see it as everybody simply remaining in the same place.
There are, as we've discussed, there are a cast of characters here, the sort of the central two, Jonathan and Hazel, and then a number of others in characters that are, you know, more sort of less and less about, in a sense that they come closer to being less characters and more plot devices. And I wonder how you think about that, how you think about minor characters and how much, in a sense, you owe them to be fully rounded so that you have a sense, yes, this is a real person, or whether you feel that you do need to have people that will move the plot in certain directions, and they don't have to be totally fully drawn characters.
That's a wonderful and very writerly question. I think as you were talking, I was thinking about Kent Harouf's novel, Plain Song, which is organized it's a kind of ensemble novel. There's about seven or eight characters, and you'd be hard pressed to say quite which is the main character. I think my novel owes something to that same way of thinking, that Jonathan and Hazel are the spine of the novel. They're the kind of through line. But Charlotte and Freddie and Maud and Bernadette and then Mrs. Craig and Mr. Early kind of form these outer rings, outer circles, all influencing the plot in various ways. And I think what I had in mind was partly, it sounds presumptuous, the great Shakespearean plays, you know, things like King Lear, where you get Edmund and Edgar, the good brother and the bad brother, or, you know, Goneril and Regan versus Cordelia. And you get all these sets of characters kind of dancing round the main story and echoing and reflecting each other. And I wanted to create some of that effect in The Missing World, that you would see a character like Mrs. Craig.
She's the next-door neighbor.
Who is Hazel and Jonathan's next-door neighbor. Might seem at first like she's going to be a totally good person, but then she'll suddenly swerve and, you know, you'll realize, oh, no, it isn't quite as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think also that this, one of the differences between the way we write fiction now and the way Jane Austen wrote fiction is that in the one kind of fiction, there's sort of this notion that there is a completely drawn and in some ways very insular world in which these characters that we all come to know fairly well move and affect one another's lives, and that they're fairly well known to one another almost on a day-to-day basis. But that's not the way life is now. Maybe it never was. And that now in fiction, we more often acknowledge the fact that people, it's sort of like pinball. I mean, people bounce off each other and, you know, something might happen. You might have an encounter with another person that then sends each of you off in an unexpected direction and you may never see that person again. And yet that's kind of the way life works.
Yes. I mean, I think it's a tremendous challenge for a novelist. In British parish registers, the registers that are kept in churches of marriages and deaths, you can see this marked change when the bicycle became popular, because up until that point, people basically married someone within walking distance. I mean, what else were you going to do? And then suddenly with bicycles, things started getting much more confusing because you could bicycle to the next village, say, and court somebody there and maybe reinvent yourself a little bit. And now, of course, we've taken that to an extreme, which makes the novelist's task very challenging.
We're at the point here, we have about, maybe 10, 12 minutes left, and I should introduce again our guest. We're talking with Margot Livesey. She is the author of The Missing World. That's her third novel and most recent. It's available in paper now. It's just come out recently, published by Penguin. She's visiting here in Champaign-Urbana to talk about her writing. In fact, we'll give a reading from The Missing World this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Illini Union Bookstore. So if you're interested, you can stop by there. Her other novels include Homework and Criminals, and then her newest, Eva Moves the Furniture, published in the fall.
It's coming out in September, yes.
All right. She is native of Scotland and now divides her time between London and Massachusetts, where she's a writer in residence at Emerson College. Questions certainly are welcome. 333-WYLL, toll-free 800-222-WYLL. So how, after growing up in Britain, did you come to be living in the United States?
Well, I wonder that myself, in fact. I grew up in a fairly remote part of Scotland. My father taught at a boys' private school that had been founded by the 19th century Prime Minister William Gladstone for the sons of clergymen. And Gladstone's idea was perhaps the rather simplistic one, to keep these young men far from the ways of vice. So he made the school way out in the countryside. And my father taught there in this quite isolated community. So that was where I grew up. Although, of course, I had to go to the nearest girls' school, which was 10 miles away. I mean, girls were not really allowed across the threshold at that point. Then I went to the University of York in England, where I studied English and philosophy. If I had wanted to study creative writing at that time, it would not have been a possibility, but it didn't really occur to me, I think, although I had always thought that in some way I would write. And the year after university, I went traveling with my boyfriend, and he was writing a book. I didn't know what to do while he was writing, so I imitated him. And what I wrote, because I didn't have a subject matter precisely, was a novel. And when I got to the end of that year of traveling, I had written a novel, and I reread it. And what captured my interest was that it was remarkably bad. And it was just dreadful. And I really was sort of bewildered, because that year I read nothing that wasn't magnificent. I was reading the great 19th and early 20th century novels. You know, I was reading Madame Flaubert and Anna Karenina and Howard's End and 100 Years of Solitude. And everything I was reading was magnificent. And yet none of that had got on. I was completely uninfluenced by the magnificence of my reading. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And from that point on, I began to pay more attention to writing. And my friend was teaching at the University of Toronto, and I came there and started working in and managing a restaurant there, but writing fiction between my split shifts.
Mm. When you said that you had written this novel and looked back on it and thought that it was remarkably bad, What was it about it that that wasn't right?
Well, I think from our earliest reading, we read fiction as very small children, and there's characters and there's dialogue and there's a plot, and we take all those things for granted. But I did have characters and I did have a plot, but for instance, my dialogue was extremely wooden. I had no sense of how to write dialogue, and I had no sense of how to kind of balance the element of a novel to create this illusion of realism that we encounter when we're three or four and becomes so much a part of our reading experience that we don't really know what creates it, I think, as readers. Mm. And it took starting to read as a writer, it took me years to figure that out and many false attempts.
You're now living part of the time in Britain and part of the time in the United States. What do you like about the two places, and in what ways are the what are the important differences between living in Boston or living in Massachusetts and living in London?
I have to confess, I actually spend most of my time in Boston. I mean, really, I'm there for 9 months a year. I'm a migrant worker in lots of ways. Living in America is like living in the future. I mean, things happen here first, and the effects of things are felt here first. And so I get to be here and to see that. Then I go back to Britain, which is home in a historical and in a spiritual sense. And I slowly get to watch those things cross over, some good, some bad, some more mixed. So there's great advantages in a way. I feel like at its best, I have two lives. At its worst, I feel like I have a muddled and confused and faulty single life.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that you talked about the missing world being a very, even though it's set in London, being an American novel reflecting the American tendency to reinvent oneself. Do you find that, and I suppose it's inescapable because the culture of the modern industrial Western world, which is pretty much the culture of the United States, is now everywhere. Do you find that there are ways that England is becoming more like America?
I think it undoubtedly is, for both good or ill, but there are severe limiting factors. Geography is one, for example. I mean, in America, you do have the luxury, if that's what one should call it, of moving 2,000 miles from home and still being able to speak the same language and get cheap phone rates. In Britain, you can put your mind to it. You can maybe move 500 miles from home, and or maybe 600. But you'll be moving from one fairly remote place, say Cornwall, to the north of Scotland to accomplish that.
Mm-hmm.
So there is much more. The country is much more unified in certain ways, and people probably move less seldom. And I suspect they have less of a sense of there always being, somewhere else to try or somewhere else to go.
Hmm. I wonder, in the United States, I think one of the things that we talk about a lot is the fact that we're losing regional culture. That is, it seems that no matter where you go, they're watching the same movies and television programs. And when they go to the mall, they go to the the Gap, and they go to Starbucks. Just this morning on National Public Radio, we heard some New Yorkers decrying the fact that now New York City is kind of like a big mall, just like any place else. And so we have this concern that even though, as you say, you could, if you were living in New York, you could pick up and you could move to Phoenix, or you could move to Los Angeles, or you could move to Seattle, but that there would be some way in which all those places are now becoming kind of the same. And I wonder whether people in Britain have that same concern, I would expect that there are still significant differences between the people in Cornwall and the people in Scotland.
I think that's correct. I think people still do have a more profound sense of choosing between city and country life, between city and town life. I mean, I'm not sure there really are towns, so many towns in America. I think Champaign-Urbana is a town, but that's probably a kind of exceptional situation. There may not be another one for thousands of miles, I'm not sure. So I think there feel like very distinct choices still to be made in Britain. Living in Scotland versus living in the south of England is a very real choice in terms of culture and lifestyle and various other issues.
Mm. We're coming down to having a couple of minutes left. I wonder, maybe you might do a little more reading.
A little more reading.
That would be all right.
No, one of my favorite activities, although not invariably allowed. I wanted to read a little bit about one of my minor characters. Charlotte is an unemployed actress and possibly an unemployable actress. A few miles away, in another part of the city, Charlotte stared at her visitors aghast. Ever since her sister dropped in last autumn, she'd had a firm rule about uninvited callers. But at least she need not compound the error of opening the door by allowing her landlord even one step inside. Barely taller than she was, with a belly as high and round as if he'd swallowed a beach ball, Mr. Aziz was smiling in a way that made her clutch her coat more tightly over her nightdress. "Miss Granger," he said, with a little bow that somehow did not involve his belly. "There seems to be a problem with the post." In his hand he held a stack of envelopes, presumably collected from the ledge in the hall where mail for Charlotte and the other tenants piled up. Ignoring the envelopes, Charlotte began to babble. "I've been away doing the Christmas pantomime in York. Peter Pan? I was Wendy. Didn't you get my note?" "Oddly, no. But here we are. It's 4 months since you paid rent. Am I to assume..." His small brown eyes grew even smaller. "That you are moving out?" Would crying help, or was the high road of indignation better? "No," she managed, and louder, firmer. "No, I'm not." "So, I will have a banker's check by the end of the week." "I swear." Then, as her hand closed around the letters, she realized the recklessness of her promise. "The end of the month," she amended. "When the theatre pays me." Mr. Aziz, frowning, reached into his pocket and produced a diary. "3 weeks. You're asking me to wait 3 weeks for 4 months' rent. 5 by that time." "Please, I've been a good tenant. No fuss, no repairs. If I get the money sooner, so will you. But by the end of the month, for sure." "Cross my heart," she almost added. Instead, she concentrated on parting her lips and letting her coat fall open just an inch, a damsel in distress.
Charlotte is an out-of-work actress who spends a lot of her time acting in her daily relationships and is also, like other people, is trying to forget something in her past, I guess in her case. Among other things, it's a love affair that didn't turn out the way that she would have liked.
Yes, I'm devoted to Charlotte. She's actually, I think, probably my favorite character in the novel. She has this kind of Walter Mitty quality of buoyancy. However badly things are going, she finds a kind of good angle to tell people.
And she is the one who I think says in the she's with Hazel in the novel, and Hazel is talking about how sad it is not to be able to remember, and Charlotte says something like it's a good thing that we can forget.
Yes, and that is the other side. The other side of memory. I mean, we think of it as being something wonderful if we could remember everything. But in fact, imagine what it would be like to remember every minute of every day. It would just be, for one thing, amazingly cluttered.
Well, I'm sorry to say we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. But for people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can hear more from our guest, Margot Livesey. She'll read from her latest novel, The Missing World, today at 4 o'clock at the Illini Union Bookstore. And, of course, if you'd like to read it, it's in the bookstores. It's published by Penguin. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.